Fourth, make each member responsible for the team product. People need to feel their contributions are important. Otherwise, they'll devote less than complete attention to the tasks at hand. Make the project belong to the team. Let as many decisions as possible bubble up from the group. Invite participation. Don't dictate solutions. Don't insist that things be done a certain way. Fifth, share the glory. Accept the blame. When the team does well and is recognized, it's the leader's responsibility to spread the benefits around. Dennis Potvin, former captain of the New York Islanders hockey team, knew how to share the glory when his team won the Stanley Cup. But just in case he didn't, Coach Al Arbour knew enough about team play to remind him. Make sure you let the other guys carry the cup, the coach whispered into Potvin's ear a few seconds after the final buzzer of the championship game. I was very impressed, Potvin recalls. Here is a guy who is in total control of the team. He was still thinking about his players, even though the Stanley Cup had just been won his first time as a coach. A public pat on the back, a bonus from the top, a write-up in the company magazine. Whatever form that recognition takes, everyone should get a generous share of it. Sixth, take every opportunity to build confidence in the team. A great leader will believe firmly in the team and will share that belief with every member. Seventh, be involved, stay involved. In those old pyramid companies, it was easy for the boss to remain relatively aloof. This approach doesn't fly in the new team-based world. The strong leader has to be involved and stay involved. The leader really does have to be there. And finally, eighth, be a mentor. It's the leader's job to develop the talents and strengthen the people on the team. This is true in the short term as the team members deal with their assignment at hand, but it's also true long term. The leaders must take a genuine responsibility for the lives and careers of the members of the team. How would you like to improve? Where do you want your career to go from here? What kinds of new responsibilities would you like to be taking on? It's the leader's job to ask all those questions and to use whatever knowledge and experience you possess to help team members achieve those goals. As Walter Lippmann wrote upon the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the final test of a leader is that he leaves behind him in other men the conviction and the will to carry on. Team players are the leaders of tomorrow. Handling mistakes, complaints, and criticism. There are two fundamental facts about mistakes. Fact number one, we all make them. Fact number two, we're more than happy to point them out in others, but boy, how we hate it when someone points out one of ours. Noel Coward was as thick-skinned about criticism as anyone, but at least he had a sense of humor. I love criticism, just so long as it's unqualified praise. But mistakes get made. Arguments arise, complaints, both legitimate and exaggerated, get lodged day after day. Customers are unhappy. Nobody is on target all the time. Criticism or blame spreading almost always causes people to duck and hide. People who have been on the receiving end of harsh criticism are far less likely to take risks, to be creative, to go out on a limb of any kind. Instantly, the organization has lost an important part of that employee's potential. So how do you handle the knowledge that nobody's perfect, but criticism is hard to swallow? With a little practice and the help of a few time-tested human relations techniques. The first step is to create an environment where people are open to receiving advice or constructive criticism. Spread the word again and again that mistakes are a natural part of life. One sure way to get this message across is to admit your own mistakes. Back in 1987, Dun & Bradstreet software chairman John Imlay said, I had to give a speech on the west coast of the United States to a group of chief information officers, I guess about 1,000 of them. To open it, I was talking about what's in and what's out. Noriega's out, democracy's in, things like that. The last one was, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are in, Ken and Barbie are out. Everybody laughed, except one fellow, one of my key customers. He was the head of Mattel. So before I returned to the office, I received a letter. The letter said, "I enjoyed your speech, but you made one mistake that I want you to retract forever." He went on in a blistering way, finally summing up by saying, "The sales of Barbie are more than the combined revenues of all your companies." So I wrote him a letter apologizing, and I wrote Barbie a letter. He didn't think that was funny either. Did Imlay give up there? Absolutely not. For years, I took his letter and put it into a slot, and every speech I gave, I reminded the audience how you have to be sensitive to the customer's issues, and customers absolutely loved the slot. One day, I spoke at the Waldorf Astoria in New York. As I gave the speech, someone passed me a note, and it said, "The president of Mattel is here." And I had him stand up, and he came up and shook my hand. Then he dropped me a note afterward and said, "All is forgiven." And he's been a happy customer ever since. The lesson here, admit your mistakes before anyone else has a chance to point them out. Laugh about them if you can. Never seek to minimize the impact they've had. The second step for handling mistakes or problems, think twice before you criticize or assign blame. If the person who made the mistake already knows how it happened, why it happened, and what needs to be done so it won't happen again, then nothing at all needs to be said. There's no point in making people feel worse than they already do. The point is avoiding the blame game. And Ray Stata, the chairman of Analog Devices Incorporated, knows all about it. The instinctive question when something goes wrong is, who's to blame, Stata observes. It's the way the human mind is wired. You want to find somebody to blame and talk about their mistakes. You have to ask yourself, what am I trying to accomplish here? Stata says, at the end of the day, what you want to do is create effective action that makes the place better. And talking about who is wrong or what's to blame is not it. The real goal is to improve the situation. There are exceptions, of course. Sometimes people do need to be criticized constructively. If the need is urgent enough, if the danger is severe enough, and if the mistake is made often enough, then something needs to be said. If after thoughtful consideration you do decide you have to discuss a situation, criticize respectfully. That's step number three. Walk softly and leave the big stick at home. Dale Carnegie said, "The process of criticism should begin with praise and honest appreciation." One great technique is using encouragement. Make the fault seem easy to correct. This is the same principle that is practiced by New York Life's Fred Sievert. He calls it his sandwich technique for giving criticism. I start by talking about the positive things that the employee has accomplished. Then, in the middle, we talk about the areas for development and improvement. Finally, we close with a discussion of how valuable the person is to New York Life. It always works. I had a boss once who did that with me, and I used to walk out of the room scratching my head saying, "Gee, I really feel good about getting reprimanded." Equally important is knowing what to avoid. Never argue, demean, or shout at someone. If you're arguing with someone, you've already lost. You've lost control of yourself, you've lost your perspective, and most significantly, you've lost sight of your goal, to communicate, to persuade, to motivate. Gentle persuasion always works better than screaming and finger-pointing. Remember, all people from the president of the most successful corporation to the clerk at the supermarket bottle return want to be told that they're capable and their efforts are recognized. A little bit of recognition, a dash of encouragement at just the right moment is often all it takes to transform a good employee into a great one. Why, asked Dale Carnegie, don't we use the same common sense when trying to change people that we use when trying to change dogs? Why don't we use meat instead of a whip? Why don't we use praise instead of condemnation? Let's praise even the slightest improvement. That inspires the other person to keep on improving. Be quick to admit mistakes and slow to criticize. Above all, be constructive. Setting goals. Most big challenges are best faced with a series of interim goals. That's a far more encouraging process, far more motivating too. Dr. James D. Watson, the director of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, who also won a Nobel Prize for discovering the structure of DNA, has been locked in a lifelong struggle to find the cure for cancer. Is that his only goal? Of course not. That would be too discouraging for anyone to bear. Watson has laid out a series of incremental goals for himself and his laboratory colleagues, goals they are meeting every year on the road to the ultimate cure. You've got to pick interim goals, he says. The goal is not to kill colon cancer tomorrow. It's to understand the disease. And there are many different steps. No one wants to be led into defeat. You get your happiness one small goal at a time. Arthur Ashe, the late tennis champion, almost single-handedly broke down the color barrier in professional tennis, a game that, until he came along, had been almost exclusively white. In his later years, Ashe fought a valiant battle against the AIDS virus, raising consciousness about the disease on ghetto street corners and in townhouse drawing rooms. His was a life of setting and reaching goals. In an interview just before his death, Ashe said, "Breaking through that barrier where you have to set a goal and you achieve that goal, it sort of codifies whatever budding self-confidence you might have had." For Ashe, it started as a youngster on a tennis court. That's where he learned about achievement one goal at a time. And that's how Ashe operated until the day he died. He'd set a goal, and when he'd met that goal, he'd set another one. Why? The self-confidence itself, I think, transforms the individual, he explained. It also spills over into other areas of life. Not only do you feel confident in whatever you are expert at, but you probably feel generally self-confident that you can do some other things as well, applying the same principles maybe to another task or to another set of goals. The goals must be realistic, and they must be attainable. Maybe you can't reach the moon this year, so plan a shorter trip. Set an interim goal. Following that incremental approach, Ashe put himself on the big-time tennis map. My early coaches set out definite goals which I bought into, and the goals were not necessarily winning tennis tournaments. The goals were just things that we saw as difficult, that would require some hard work and some planning. Before I knew it, after I attained these mini goals along the way, all of a sudden, hey, I'm close to the big prize here. In a tournament, you'd want to get to the quarterfinals, or in a match, you would want to not miss a certain number of backhand passing shots. Or maybe you'd want to improve your stamina to a point where you're not going to get tired when the weather is too hot. Those are the sorts of goals that help take your general focus off that long-range, elusive goal, the goal of being number one or winning the whole tournament. Goals. They give us something to shoot for. They keep our efforts focused. They allow us to measure our success. So, set goals. Goals that are challenging, but also are realistic. Goals that are clear and measurable. Goals for the short term and goals for the long term. And when you reach one goal, take a second to pat yourself on the back, then move on to the next goal, emboldened, strengthened, energized by what you've already achieved. Without specific goals, it's far too easy just to drift, never really taking charge of your life. Time gets wasted because nothing has a sense of urgency. There's no deadline. In the words of Harvey McKay, the best-selling business author, a goal is a dream with a deadline. Long before Lou Holtz became Notre Dame's head football coach, he wanted nothing more than to play the game himself. But when he went out for his high school team, he weighed just 115 pounds. Holtz knew this was far too small. Still, he desperately wanted to play, so he came up with a plan. He memorized all 11 positions on the team. That way, if any player got hurt, he was immediately prepared to rush onto the field. It gave him 11 chances instead of one. It's the same way in business today, says writer Harvey McKay. If you're working out here in the office, volunteer to learn the phone system. If you're in sales, you want to know about computers. That way, when opportunities appear, you'll have a much greater chance of seizing them. Set goals that make you more valuable to your team, as Lou Holtz did, or to your company. The idea is to set goals and then strive to meet them. Sometimes you'll succeed on schedule, sometimes things take a little longer to achieve than you thought. The point is to keep planning and plugging away. You'll get there. Just watch. Set goals that are clear, challenging, and obtainable. Focus and discipline. Dale Carnegie said, "Patience and perseverance will accomplish more in this world than a brilliant dash." Remember that when something goes wrong. Don't let anything discourage you. Keep on. Never give up. That has been the policy of most of those who have succeeded. Of course, discouragement will come. The important thing is to surmount it. If you can do that, the world is yours. Having a goal is a part of winning the big prize. Focus and discipline make up the other half of the equation. To get what you want in life, you've got to believe in yourself, and you've got to be willing to keep after it. Try again and again and again. And be sure to follow through on things. That's not always easy. You have to train yourself to march through every step, to complete every detail of every job every time. That's what makes people more valuable to a company, more crucial to an organization, more trustworthy to their colleagues and friends. Following through on every detail. It's old values like getting to an appointment early, remembering to follow through on your promises, and having pride in your work, says Joyce Harvey of Harmon Associates, a wholly owned subsidiary of Fort Howard Corporation. If you're doing a letter of credit, you've got to follow steps 1 to 4. You can't skip step 3. Mistakes are costly. Don't move too fast. Check your details and stay focused. In the case of Dr. Scott Coyne, focus and discipline literally made the difference between life and death. Coyne, a radiologist, was the first doctor on the scene when an Avianca Boeing 727 crashed near his home on Long Island one wretched January night. One by one, he had to tend to the passengers' injuries. He also had to soothe their nerves, and he had to do it without speaking, since most of the people on the plane were from Colombia and didn't speak any English. Coyne's Spanish didn't go much beyond, "Doctor, doctor." Coyne said he made himself understood by focusing every fiber of his being. "I was able to communicate by touching faces. You could tell how bad they'd been hurt by how they looked at you. I had to whisper in their ears. I had to maintain composure and hold them and try to reassure them just by my expression and by my touch. I was unable to get a history from anybody. You know, you can't ask them where they're hurting. How bad does it hurt? Does the back hurt? I had to literally check every patient from head to toe, and then, as I went down the row, I'd find these fractures were just grotesque. I've never seen fractures like this. Legs were literally hanging off. And I'd check these fractures and start IVs the best I could, and then go to the next patient and start all over." Coyne's focus was so intense that everything peripheral was just blocked out of his mind. He discovered just how focused he had been later when he spoke about the accident at a stress management seminar. The others in the group were describing all the mayhem they'd expect in that kind of circumstance. Ambulances and fire trucks and squawking radios and screaming survivors and rescue workers yelling back and forth. Coyne heard none of it. "What I remember is how quiet it was. You had to focus so much you didn't hear. It was like a trance. The only thing I did hear was helicopters about an hour later. Helicopters came in to evacuate some of the injured people." Focus, the ability to ignore distractions and pursue only what was important, that's what made the difference that night and helped save all those lives. Leaders never lose their focus, but keep their eyes on the big picture. Achieving balance. Dale Carnegie wrote, "The United States Army has discovered by repeated tests that even men toughened by years of Army training can march better and hold up longer if they throw down their packs and rest 10 minutes of every hour. So the Army forces them to do just that. It is vital for all modern leaders to balance out their lives, to make room for things other than work. It's a critical part of every successful life. I don't think it's possible to be a great manager or a great executive without being a total person, says Andres Navarro, president of Sonda SA, a Chilean computer systems company. Navarro has an apt analogy. If you want to be an athlete, maybe to throw the javelin, it's not enough to have the strongest arm. You need the whole body to be strong. And if you want to be a great leader, you need all parts of your life to be strong and intact. You see, explains Navarro, a good executive who makes great decisions and makes money too in a company, but doesn't get along with his wife, his children, and other people in general, is missing a crucial part of life. If you want to grow and be a good leader, you've got to be a complete man or a complete woman, and the most important part of it is your family. Undeniably, most modern leaders don't achieve a perfect balance all of the time. The many balls that are being juggled aren't easy to keep aloft. The usual tendency for ambitious people is to put the business first. It just seems so much more urgent, so much more pressing, so much more crucial. Singer-songwriter Neil Sedaka had two close friends growing up in Brooklyn, a young couple who had great ambition in their lives, but also just loved to have a good time. Over the years, they both achieved tremendous professional and financial success, but they lost something along the way. It was the balance they once knew in their lives. Sedaka wrote a song about his friends, which turned into a giant hit. The song was called The Hungry Years. They struggled to hit the top, Sedaka recalls, success and money. But when they finally did it, they discovered that they missed the times when they were just getting started, when they were hanging out in the old neighborhood, when they were building a life together. It's like, I want that $5 million home. But then you finally hit it. You actually get to move in. And after a couple of months, you say, is this all? Is this it? You miss those years that you did things together. You've lost some of the pleasure and balance in your life. There's nothing wrong with material success, but that alone is not enough to sustain a happy life. Attaining a reasonable division of time between work and leisure is the greatest challenge, said Ray Stata, chairman of Analog Devices Incorporated, a manufacturer of high-performance integrated circuits. But it's worth the effort to master the challenge. William Makahilahila at SGS Thompson makes time for himself every day, even though it means getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Makahilahila explained his practice of pre-dawn rising. I'm busy all day. I'm usually at the office until 7 or 8 in the evening. I don't know why, but I've just gotten to the point where I am in deep meditation in the mornings. It's so quiet. I can stretch myself, be creative, read, or reflect on my day. The benefits for Makahilahila are immediate. When I've done that, I begin to have peace of mind and self-confidence, even in the midst of the deepest problems that I know I'm going to have to face that day. How can you start balancing your life? The first step is to change your attitude. You've got to stop thinking of time for your family, for exercise, or for leisure as wasted time. Achievers often feel they need to apologize for leisure time. Try to rid yourself of that thought. Relaxation is not a dirty word. This leads to the second step in the process. You have to make time for leisure activity. Most of us are overcommitted. Perhaps it's time to reevaluate priorities. Make a decision to devote as much energy to planning your leisure time as you devote to planning your workday. The third step is to act. Do something. Get involved in activities that are not work-related. They will leave you happier, healthier, more focused, and, as a result, a better leader. Consistently high performance comes from a balance between work and leisure. Learning not to worry. You and I, Dale Carnegie wrote, are standing this very second at the meeting place of two eternities, the vast past that has endured forever, and the future that is plunging on to the last syllable of recorded time. We can't possibly live in either of those eternities, no, not even for one split second. But by trying to do so, we can wreck both our bodies and our minds. So let's be content to live the only time we can possibly live, from now until bedtime. Carnegie spent 7 years reading and studying about worry. He interviewed all the leading experts of the day. He read every worry book he could get his hands on. Out of all that research came a book about worry and stress, How to Stop Worrying and Start Living, which was published in 1944. For the first time ever, the basic techniques for overcoming worry were laid out in a simple, straightforward way. Obviously, the years since then have brought with them many new causes for worry, but the timeless principles that Carnegie set down are still as fresh as ever. Learn these techniques. Apply them every day. Almost certainly, you will gain greater control over your life. You will experience less stress and worry. You will end up mentally and physically healthier, too. 1. Live in day-tight compartments. It's mind-boggling to think about how much energy gets wasted on the future and on the past. The past is over, and the future hasn't yet arrived. There's only one time we can possibly live in. That time is the present. That time is today. So work in the realm of the present. Put your energy, put your attention, put your drive where it will count. Today. And then get to work. You just may be surprised by how much can be accomplished in one day-tight compartment. 2. Take comfort from the law of averages. By asking yourself just one question and paying attention to what the answer is, you chase a good chunk of worry from your life. The question is this: how likely is this thing to happen anyway? Most of the things that most people worry about don't happen. That's worth remembering. My life, wrote the French philosopher Montaigne, has been full of terrible misfortunes, most of which never happened. 3. Cooperate with the inevitable. Every day, our lives will be peppered with unpleasant realities of various sorts. Some of them we will be lucky enough or skillful enough to change, but there will always be problems that are beyond our reach. When we stop fighting the inevitable, that is when we have the time, the energy, and the creativity to solve the problems that we can. Put a stop-loss order on your worries. Try asking yourself the question that Wall Street investors ask themselves whenever the market falls: how much of a loss am I willing to take on this investment? At what point do I just take the beating and walk away? You can follow the same system when it comes to worry. Ask yourself, how much worry is this one problem worth? Is it worth one sleepless night? Is it worth a week's worth of anxiety? Is it worth an ulcer to me? Very, very few problems should be. 4. Keep things in perspective. Some things aren't worth worrying about at all. They're just too tiny. Most of the time, it just doesn't matter. Yet we all know people who have turned their lives inside out over such trivialities. What a waste! 5. And finally, get busy. Nothing takes your mind off worry like having it occupied with something else. That's a technique professional actors need to learn in a hurry. When you're up for a big film, said Annette Bening, who has had major roles in Bugsy, The Grifters, and other films, the waiting period can be months. They meet you, then they go away. They meet other people, then they meet you again. One thing I found useful was to start working on the part. When I don't get a part, I just move on mentally, not dwell on it, and get on to the next thing. If you're finding yourself getting worried, take on a new project. Learn a new skill. Do something you believe in. Focus on the needs of others. Getting busy takes your mind off your own problems. You'll also be serving others, which will make you feel better about yourself. Despite all these fine worry-stopping techniques, you will still have problems with your life, and you will need to deal intelligently with them. Here's a useful three-step approach. If you'll just ask yourself these three questions, it's amazing how much more clearly you'll see what you're dealing with. 1. Ask yourself, what's the worst that can possibly happen? Thankfully, most of our problems are, in fact, not matters of life or death. 2. Prepare yourself mentally to accept the worst if necessary. 3. Ask yourself, what can I do to make the situation better? Work calmly and methodically to improve upon the worst. After years of struggle, things were finally looking up for Mary Kay Ash. She had remarried. The children were finally grown. She and her new husband had saved just enough money to start a small cosmetics company, a dream she had nurtured for years. Then her dream nearly disintegrated. The day before we were to open this company, Ash recalls, my husband died of a heart attack right there at the breakfast table. My husband was to handle the administration of the company. I don't know a thing about administration, even today. Every single penny was committed. We had only $5,000, my personal savings. It sounds like very little, but probably it would be worth $50,000 today. On the day of the funeral, we had no time to waste. My two sons and my daughter and I sat down to decide what to do. Do I stop or do I go on? All my dreams just plunged to the ground. But Mary Kay Ash believed in herself too much to give up. Her son Richard, who was just 20, offered to do what he could. Mother, he said, I'll move to Dallas to help you. She had her doubts. I thought, big deal. How would you like to turn your life savings over to a 20-year-old? But Ash wasn't one to let doubt overwhelm her. She doesn't take well to defeat, so she pressed on. That was the beginning of the company. True to his word, Richard moved to Dallas the very next day with his bride of 2 months under his arm. The lawyers were saying, why don't you go directly to the trash and throw the money in, because you're never going to make it? And Flitz from Washington told us how many cosmetics companies go broke every morning. Her positive attitude got her through it all. She just kept telling herself, I think it can be done, and I'm going to try. With an attitude like that, is it any surprise that Ash succeeded? These positive, self-confident feelings don't only help you achieve more, they also make other people want to be associated with you. We all respond to the attitude of others. That's why people are drawn to those with upbeat outlooks on life. We want to surround ourselves with friends or coworkers who are happy and productive, who have a can-do, it's-no-problem attitude. Just as predictably, the constant complainer in any crowd doesn't get much company. Why is this? Attitude rubs off on others, good or bad. This is a vital concept to remember for anyone who wants to be a successful leader today. There are few more powerful motivators than a positive attitude. Tame your worries and energize your life. The power of enthusiasm. Dale Carnegie once asked a friend how he chose his top subordinates, people on whose abilities his business would succeed or fail. The friend's answer might sound surprising to some. The difference in actual skill and ability and intelligence between those who succeed and those who fail is usually neither wide nor striking, said Frederick D. Williamson, president of the New York Central Railway. But if two people are nearly equally matched, the one who is enthusiastic will find the scales tipped in his favor, and a person who has second-rate ability with enthusiasm will often outstrip someone of first-rate ability without enthusiasm. The best way to get someone excited about an idea or a project or a campaign is to be excited yourself and to show it. Before we say another word on the subject of enthusiasm, let's clarify a widespread misconception once and for all. Loudness does not equal enthusiasm, nor does pounding on the table, or jumping up and down, or acting like a fool. That's fake. It's obvious. It doesn't fool anyone. It almost always does more harm than good. Enthusiasm is a feeling that has to come from inside. This concept is so important, it's worth saying again. Enthusiasm is a feeling that has to come from inside. And it's not to be confused with boisterous hype. It's true, increased physical movement and stronger voice projection sometimes accompany an inner feeling of enthusiasm. But people who indulge in superanimation, you know, I'm great, you're great, we're all so great today, might as well wear a big I'm a phony badge instead. The real enthusiasts of history understood this intuitively. Back in the 1950s, was Jonas Salk enthusiastic about creating a polio vaccine? Of course he was. He dedicated years of his life to the pursuit, and anyone who came in contact with Salk could see his enthusiasm immediately, the way his eyes lit up when he spoke about his research, the round-the-clock sessions he led in the lab, the inspiration he became for two generations of scientists. Yes, the man positively exuded enthusiasm. But Salk did not rant and rave. And now he's devoting that very same enthusiasm to finding a vaccine for the HIV virus that causes AIDS. National Hockey League Hall of Famer Dennis Potvin, who led the New York Islanders to four straight Stanley Cups, knows a little something about enthusiasm. When I got to training camp, I needed to be emotionally excited about hockey, so I didn't take the approach that some players did, thinking I should skate all summer long. I actually felt the total opposite. I didn't want to skate a lot. So when I got into training camp, I was never in as great shape physically as a lot of the people were. I knew I had to work extra hard to be in shape. But the thing I had over them was that I was genuinely enthusiastic about playing hockey again. Here it was, the 15th September of my professional career, and I felt like I was a kid again. No, you can't fake enthusiasm. But yes, absolutely yes, you can create it. You can nourish it, and you can put it to work for you. Dale Carnegie explained the process like this. The way to acquire enthusiasm is to believe in what you are doing and in yourself, and to want to get something definite accomplished. Enthusiasm will follow as night follows the day. Enthusiasm is easiest to attain when you have real goals in your life, things you are genuinely looking forward to. Let that happen, and enthusiasm will grow inside of you. Wake up in the morning and take a minute to think about something pleasing that will happen that day. Maybe it's some part of your job you always enjoy. Maybe it's a friend you're meeting for lunch. Maybe it's a family outing, a beer with your friends, an hour on the squash court, or in an aerobics class. Whatever the pleasing event is, what's important is this. Life doesn't need to be dull or uninteresting. But let's not gloss over the hard reality. There are some jobs that are simply miserable or simply inappropriate to your temperament, your skills, or your goals. If that applies to you, do something about it. You will never achieve real success if you cannot be excited by your life or your work. Many people have bounced around from job to job before finding the happy fit. There's nothing shameful about this. The shameful thing is to feel miserable about a job and not to try to make it better or find another one. If you're feeling bored with life, the people around you will be falling asleep as well. If you're sarcastic and antagonistic, they will be too. If you're lukewarm, they will never boil. True enthusiasm is made of two parts, eagerness and assurance. Be excited about something and express confidence in your ability to handle it. That's all enthusiasm takes. Have those two feelings about a company, a project, or an idea, and your enthusiasm will be dangerously contagious. You'll have it, others will know you have it, pretty soon they'll have it too. Guaranteed. Always surround yourself with happy, successful people, agrees Harvey McKay, the business book author. I don't go around with negative people. If your friends and your peers and the people you respect and the people that you're reading about are upbeat, enthusiastic, confident people with a lot of self-esteem, that will also become a part of you. It is almost impossible to underestimate the power of enthusiasm. Every great and commanding movement is the triumph of enthusiasm, Ralph Waldo Emerson once said. Nothing great was ever achieved without it. This was true of our country. It is just as true of all big companies today. Enthusiasm is as important as high ability, as important as hard work. We all know people who are brilliant and accomplish nothing. We all know people who work hard and get nowhere. But people who work hard, love their jobs, and convey enthusiasm, those are the ones who are going places. Never underestimate the power of enthusiasm. look out the window. Notice how much change has occurred out there in just the past few years. The post-war boom went bust, competition became global, consumers grew more sophisticated, quality became an expectation, whole new industries were born, and others were realigned. Most of the cushiness has gone out of modern capitalism, and with it, the stability that generations of business people had come to expect. Did Dale Carnegie anticipate every one of these changes? Of course not. No one could have in a world changing so fast. But Carnegie did something even more important than that. He left behind a timeless set of human relations principles that are even more relevant today than they were 50 years ago. They are uniquely suited to the current high-stress, fast-moving, uncertain world. The timelessness of these insights should come as no surprise. Dale Carnegie tested them constantly over the years, and he knew that they could withstand popular fads, rising and falling stocks, and the regular, if unpredictable, swing of the economic pendulum. These principles were solid. They were built around basic facts of human nature, so their essential truth never waned. You, too, can apply these principles to your daily life. Learn the importance of listening. Look at things from the other person's perspective. Offer genuine appreciation and praise. Harness the mighty power of enthusiasm. Respect the dignity of others. Don't be overly critical. Give people a good reputation to live up to. Keep a sense of fun and balance in your life. Make these basic lessons and techniques part of your daily life. Use them with your friends, family, and colleagues. See what a difference they can make. Dale Carnegie spoke about the principles he spent his life spreading around this way. The rules we have set down here are not mere theories or guesswork. They work like magic. Incredible as it sounds, I have seen the application of these principles literally revolutionize the lives of many people. So take those words to heart and find the leader in you. The leader in you. How to win friends, influence people, and succeed in a changing world. By Dale Carnegie and Associates, Inc. Stuart R. Levine, Chief Executive Officer for Dale Carnegie and Associates, Inc. And Michael A. Crum, Vice President of Dale Carnegie Centers of Excellence. The Leader in You was abridged for audio by Treby Johnson. The recording engineer was Rick Bradley, with post-production by Leszek Wojcik. The associate producer was Christine Nelson. I'm Ross Klavan. The Leader in You, How to Win Friends, Influence People, and Succeed in a Changing World, was produced and directed by Susan Perrin-Totland.